This is true of men invading a tidal pool. How much more so is it the case with men impinging on one another's minds and spirits? While individuals... wait till I find out what this sentence says. There's a word missing, and I don't know what it is. While individually these events may seem small in the huge tapestry of God's plan for men's lives, nonetheless, it is a meaningful part of the pattern. Although it's appropriate to think of Christian teaching in this broad sense, we must be concerned here with a more specific and conscious teaching task for which certain persons are set apart by the Christian community. Individuals vary in terms of the gifts of the Spirit which they have received and with respect to the way they develop and use these gifts. For this reason, the church does call certain individuals to perform particular responsibilities in carrying out educational ministries. It seeks with varying success to identify those endowed with special gifts of the Spirit for such a ministry. In designating such leaders, the church does not delegate to them a special authority over others. Rather, it names individuals for particular responsibilities in Christian service as Christ himself became the servant of all. While both leader and follower share in a general ministry and mission of the church, certain educational functions of the church have become institutionalized and assigned as particular tasks for the sake of order and expediency. Now let's look at the committed teacher. If you were to think back to the days of your own schooling, I dare say that the personalities of certain teachers with whom you worked have had much more significant influence upon you than the subjects with which they dealt. I am sure this has been my own experience. I think of Miss Bessie Koss, my high school geometry teacher. I can hear her still saying, "If you forget everything else I have done, I hope you will say that Miss Koss taught me to think things through. That's all I remember." Most of Or take Saturnine Charles Wolfe, my freshman English instructor in college. His rules for grammar have grown fuzzy, but not the way he approached the beauty and precision of the English language with a zeal that was close to reverence. And one might go on, but each of these teachers had one thing in common, a commitment to the importance of the task. They were out to change our lives, and they wanted to give us a vision of something higher than our first fumbling effort. And they gave themselves without stint to this cause. When we sense how important committed teaching is in the fields such as geometry or English, it should be obvious that it is an essential for Christian teaching. Here is a call from God himself to use one's talents in helping others grow in their lives toward more effective discipleship. The commitment is not an academic discipline, but to God's purposes for his people. In this way, the Christian teacher becomes a means whereby God himself enters and becomes a power in men's lives. I gotta find out what it is. See you in a little while. Now, several years ago in our church, we conducted a study of almost 1,600 teachers, which revealed the sense of the importance of responding to God's call in teaching in two significant ways. On the one hand was a distinction which was developed between satisfied and dissatisfied teachers. On the other hand was the extent to which teachers felt that it was necessary to undergo training in order to fulfill their call more effectively. One very important aspect of the study was an attempt to discover the characteristics of those who were very happy are satisfied in their teaching, as contrasted with those who are very unhappy or somewhat unhappy. Interestingly, the teachers who were very contented represented 38% of the sample as compared to 9% for the somewhat unhappy group. On the average, only one teacher in 175 claimed to be very unhappy in his teaching work. The group of satisfied and dissatisfied teachers differed very little in personal background, age, or education. There were very few differences in their teaching situations, such as the size of the class, the length of the period, classroom facilities, or time spent in lesson preparation. The most striking difference seemed to be that satisfied leaders view teaching as an important task, in which they are challenged to use all their talents in seeking to bring about important changes in the persons who are their pupils. Discontented leaders view teaching as an obligation, which they feel that they should undertake without having any clear concept of the results which should come from their efforts. They do not know the purposes for which they are teaching. Now, the trained and untrained teachers. In the second aspect of this research, we tried to find out the characteristic differences between teachers who had received some type of leadership education and those who had not. The results were dramatic. They may be summarized as follows. Teachers who had received leadership training had a consistently higher view of the purpose of Christian education. They viewed teaching as a form of Christian vocation. They spent more time in preparing to teach and to getting to know their pupils. They evaluated the results of their teaching on the basis of what the pupils learned, rather than pupil interest and discipline. These teachers tended to judge materials in terms of how helpful they were for pupils, rather than whether they were easy to use and teach. Generally speaking, the trained teachers were more competent. They saw less need for step-by-step instruction in their teacher's guides. They usually felt there was an abundance of materials provided and were more willing to try out new methods. They encountered fewer discipline problems. They seemed eager to learn more about doing a better job of teaching. On the other hand, the untrained teachers did not have as high motivation. Many taught for a highly personal reason, such as the enjoyment they got out of it, or they felt a sense of obligation to teach. The untrained teachers failed to look for long-term results in changes in their pupils. They judged success by present response, such as attention and immediate interest. They tended to expect less from their pupils, both in class and in terms of preparation of homework. They did not sense the importance of knowing their pupils personally. The untrained teachers revealed also a lesser degree of competence in their task. They felt poorly prepared, although they admitted spending less time in preparing to teach. They tended to blame their difficulties on the material which they used, rather than upon anything which they did themselves. They felt that their materials did not contain enough Bible. Most of them did not prepare a written lesson plan. They used fewer supplementary resources and employed a more limited variety of methods. They were less likely than the trained teachers to be sure about continuing to teach in the future. Oddly enough, they did not recognize their own lack of leadership education as contributing to their problems. Now let's look at the function of teaching. One thing which becomes obvious in the study just mentioned was that it was not enough for a person simply to have the right attitude and commitment with regard to teaching. He needed also to understand what is involved in the teaching process itself. Many leaders approach their task as though everything depends upon them and what they do in the situation. In actual practice, they tend to forget the role of both the Holy Spirit and the pupil. If what we have been saying thus far today is true, it is ultimately the power of the Holy Spirit which makes changes in Christian persons possible. But it is equally true that the final determiner of whether a pupil learns is the pupil himself. When the teacher understands this, it changes his perspective entirely. He sees himself as God's servant to the pupil in the learning process, not the controller of it. For many years, most educators assumed that people acted as they did because of some external pressure brought to bear upon them. Like rats in a maze, people were expected to respond in a certain way if a certain stimulus was given. According to this view, you could teach people anything you wanted to, provided you could set the conditions properly. Such a conception of human behavior leads to a method of dealing with human problems based upon the idea of fencing people in. It's a method familiar to any person who has lived on a farm or has ever driven the cows home from pasture. One goes down the lane from the barn to the pasture, carefully closing the gates where he does not want the cattle to go, and opening those where he wants them to go, until he reaches the pasture. In the pasture, he irritates the herd in such fashion that they will move forward, and because the route has been carefully prepared in advance, move up the lane to the barn. Now, the fencing-in technique works fine with cattle and sheep. Unfortunately, it breaks down in working with people, because people, being smarter than cattle or sheep, are always finding gates which we forgot to lock, or climbing over the fences we have so carefully erected. Indeed, when we try to use this method of dealing with people, we're often frustrated and distressed at the uncooperative attitudes of the people we try to deal with. What is implied here is that the teacher cannot control the results of the teaching-learning process. He confronts the learner again and again in many ways, with God's word as God speaks to the realities of the pupil's situation. What he hopes for is not a monologue, but a dialogue. He looks for a response from the pupil. As pupil and teacher together face each challenge of life in which one must say yes or no to God, the teacher prays that the pupil's answer will be a yes, but he cannot prevent a no. But this much the teacher knows. When the pupil has made a responsible decision, he has learned. His answer becomes his learning, whether it is what the teacher hoped for or not. In this process of Christian education, the teacher is doing more than talking about the work of God. With all his wit and wisdom, he becomes a part of that work. As Reuel Howe puts it, Christian education is a part of the gospel action in our time. When this happens, the teacher is serving as an instrument of God. Let us look then at some of the specific tasks which are his if he is to be an effective instrument. First, the teacher provides a climate for learning. One of the insights which has come from psychological research is that the atmosphere in a class influences greatly the quality of the learning by the members. If a pupil feels he's on the spot or threatened by the teacher's attitude, he finds it difficult to concentrate on learning. Frequently, this happens when a teacher tries to pose as an authority who knows all the answers. Under these circumstances, he resists disagreement by the class members and tries to maintain his status. Meanwhile, the pupil is likely to develop skill in making the teacher think he is in agreement while covertly taking an opposing view out of resistance to pressure. An experiment conducted by Ned Flanders was designed to find out the influence which learner center and teacher center techniques had upon pupils. He worked with two teachers, one trained to make learner centered comments and the other trained to make teacher centered comments. These comments came easily to the teachers, tending to fit their personalities. One student was brought in, and after a while, the first teacher started teaching. This went on for about 25 minutes until the pupil had learned what the teacher was trying to teach. Following the first teaching session, the next teacher taught a lesson using comments from the teacher-centered style of teaching. The recall at the end of 4 days was 100%. Of the principles taught during the teacher-centered period, the average recall was about 55%. Certain remarks from the tape-recorded teaching sessions were selected and scrambled. Added to this were a few make-up remarks, sheer fiction. 4 days later, the pupils were asked to put in front of each remark the symbol S if he had said it, the symbol T if the teacher had said it, and the symbol X if neither had said it. The pupil was very accurate in identifying remarks taken out of the teacher-centered period. The teacher was making self-justifying, critical, and directive remarks, and the student attributed them to the teacher. But for remarks taken out of the learner-centered period, the accuracy of discrimination approached point zero. The pupil had a difficult time untangling the comments, deciding whether he or the teacher had said it. The discussion had been similar to two voices in the pupil's head, since the teacher was working in the pupil's frame of reference. In the teacher-centered period, the frames of reference of teacher and pupil were antagonistic. Now that's one piece of research. The key to the climate of openness within a class which fosters learning seems to be a genuine concern on the part of the teacher for his pupils. When a pupil senses that the teacher cares about what he thinks and what is troubling him, he becomes willing to take the risk of exposing his feelings. And this is the level at which real changes in a person occur. Just being able to parrot right and acceptable answers is no guarantee of meaningful learning. In fact, such response can actually be a dishonest way of avoiding real change. By the way, people who listen to sermons learned that early. It is the deep-down struggle with problems that count which produce the most significant learning. The pupil will only allow these concerns to become a part of his relationship with the teacher, however, when he is sure that the teacher wants to help him find a solution. Of course, there is more involved in the climate of a class than the one-to-one relationship between pupil and teacher. The intricate interplay of feelings among all the members of the group is equally important. The teacher, however, is in a unique position to be able to help mold the proper group spirit. Not only must he be willing to accept the students for what they are, but they are also must be willing to accept one another. When this happens, there is the beginning of koinonia, a true Christian community. Competition is replaced by a desire to help one another grow and learn. When the atmosphere is permissive, problems begin to surface, and the class members discover a deep satisfaction in helping others find answers to their concerns. Interpreting objectives. What we have just been saying about the climate of the classroom should not be taken to imply that the teacher is pushed this way and that by the momentary interests of the pupils. The teacher, as the representative of the educating community, is responsible for communicating to the class the objectives which the community believes to be desirable. If these objectives have been properly defined, they will be relevant to the pupil's real needs, although he may not be aware of this at the outset. The teacher, therefore, stands in the position of maintaining the delicate balance between pupil interest and the ends toward which the whole educative process is moving. What Nathaniel Cantor has to say about the problem in relation to public education could very well apply to the Christian community also. He says, "We're not proposing that the classrooms of the country be turned into playgrounds in which pupils play cops and robbers for 12 years or indulge in fitful fancies of the moment. If a 2-year-old trips on the stairway in a home and the progressive parents install an escalator to prevent further accidents, psychiatric care for the parents is indicated. The child must learn to deal with stairways, even though he prefers being carried. The process is gradual. First, he encounters the gate which bars the passage. This helps him to learn the first initial that there is an obstacle. Then he is given a helping hand in making the first initial step or two. He clings to the parent's hand, wanting to explore, but still somewhat uncertain. The achievement of climbing the first stair unassisted is a signal victory. This is followed by a triumphal crawling, walking up and down the stairs. The classroom presents a challenge. There are steep stairs which the pupil must climb. What are the capacities and strengths and readiness of the pupil? Learning must begin where the pupil is, not where the teacher says or hopes he is. The material, the content, cannot be ignored. That is a reality. The quintessential problem for the teacher is to be aware of pupil readiness, to observe the signs, to understand the feelings, and to extend the hand of sympathetic guidance to lead, to lift, to comfort, to correct, and to challenge. The stairway must be climbed if the pupil is to arrive at the desired goal. That is given. That some ways are more effective than others to accomplish this must be learned. One reason that pupils have difficulty climbing the educational stairway is because it's so long. The big goals are far off and seemingly unattainable. The step which needs to be taken today appears quite unrelated to the distant objective. Often the values involved seem too remote. The teacher naturally must have the long-term objectives of Christian education in mind. He can assist the pupil's learning, however, by dividing this into manageable portions. As one educator puts it, the immediate objectives for a class should be chewable bites. This process of helping pupils relate today's activity to a larger purpose is one of the teacher's most valuable functions. It suffuses the immediate and ultimate meaning. It is a salutary thing for each teacher to recognize how limited the aims are for one session or unit. We often talk about educating the whole person, and to this is true. A pupil always reacts as a whole person, but he also needs to attack his learning task step by step. At one moment, he may need some item of information, a bit of content which he didn't know. Another point, he may be painfully restructuring one small aspect of his attitude toward other people. The teacher must ever be about the business of recognizing the pupil's present inadequacy, and by helping him overcome it, also enable him to move toward the distant goal. Providing learning experiences. Once pupil and teacher have come to a clear view in the educational objectives to be sought, the learner must still be helped to discover a way of achieving them. There is no other way for a person to learn than to go through some kind of experience. The teacher cannot learn for the pupil. The learner must be involved in some act, such as listening, reading, discussing, or doing something he has never done before. Education is a process of gradually opening the doors of new experience at a pace with which the learner can deal satisfactorily. It is the teacher's job to introduce these opportunities for learning into the pupil's field of experience at the appropriate time. Another way of putting this is to say that the teacher must plan methods of teaching which provide methods of learning. Educational method is a tool with two handles. It is the way in which the teacher designs a means for the learner to reach the objective through their common effort. Well, someone may object. I think it's far more important what I teach than how I teach. The truth of the matter is that both are important. Each is intimately related to the other. As Iris Cully puts it, the what conditions the how. Methods or media merely means for accomplishing an end. It is always possible, in complete sincerity, to use wrong means toward a right end. That is why methodology is in constant process of reevaluation. Emil Brunner has a word on that subject. He writes, "We are certainly not concerned here with a question of mere psychology. What I should say to a man upon his deathbed is a holy matter. But it is a matter no less holy how I am to say it to him in such a way that he shall understand and appreciate it. A pastor might, to put it somewhat strongly, go to heaven on account of what he said, but go to hell on account of the how he said it. To despise the question of the how is a sign not of theological seriousness, but of theological intellectualism. The what is, as it were, guarded by faith, but the how has to be guarded by love. But where the how, and therefore love, is lacking, their faith must be lacking also. And there can be no question that methodology is important." Sometimes church school teachers are inclined to view the newer types of educational experiences with some suspicion, since many of these techniques have been developed in the secular education field. It's argued that they are godless or even demonic. Actually, educational methods or learning experiences are not Christian or unchristian in and of themselves. They are basically neutral. It is the purposes for which they are employed and the spirit in which they are used which colors them. Any method can be used to manipulate people against their wills, or it can be employed to evoke a free and responsible decision. Helping pupils recognize error. One of the most difficult roles that the teacher has to learn is that of knowing when to correct a pupil's error. Sometimes it is assumed that since the final responsibility of learning rests with the pupil, the teacher ought not to tell the learner when he is wrong. Becoming aware of mistakes is one way in which we learn. Of course, there are many instances in which the individual recognizes error and corrects it on his own without any serious consequences. In other cases, however, it would be disastrous to let him plunge ahead without a knowledge of what is likely to happen. A chemistry teacher would never allow a student to mix nitric acid, sulfuric acid, and glycerol in a laboratory just to see what would happen. He would have a moral obligation to prevent the destructive consequences. Frequently, people simply do not know enough about a given field to sense when they are wrong or why. An experiment with helping children learn how to throw darts, it was discovered that one group of children who were not assisted in understanding their mistakes continued in the same error. A second group quickly improved when they were shown the wrong techniques they were using. When we get into the field of religious learning, of course, the problem of recognizing error is often more complex. Some teachers have an unhappy tendency to stifle with heavy-handed correction any creative thinking which disagrees with their own fixed positions. It must be admitted there are large areas in ethics, for example, where there is room for honest difference of opinion. Many church school teachers, however, have acted as though there was always a right answer, and that any disagreement was not only erroneous, but also sinful. It must be realized that in a rapidly changing world such as ours, circumstances arise in the lives of pupils which have never been encountered in the teacher's own experience. Here a strategy of a common quest for the best solution is much happier approach than for the leader to claim to have the answer. One of the exciting aspects of the Christian life is that it is not a completely closed system. The dynamic of the gospel creates new edges of growth in every generation. Wise is the teacher who can distinguish between genuine threats to known truth and unsuspected but fresh insights into reality. Maintaining growth in learning. Achieving a learning goal within the classroom is one thing. The real test is maintaining that change once the support of the teacher and the class group are no longer present. Unfortunately, this is a point at which the learnings acquired in the church school so often break down. The pupil makes the desired change within the security of the classroom, but reverts to his own former position under external pressure. Leland Bradford suggests five things which can be done to assist the learner to maintain change and use what he's learned. First, help needs to be given to the learner in diagnosing forces of resistance to change and support to change likely to be found in himself and his environment. Basically, he needs help in locating and building supports in his internal and external worlds to maintain new learning and change. And second, help needs to be given to the learner in assessing his own potential strengths and weaknesses in terms of supportive change. And third, help should be given the learner in planning how to reestablish himself in his outside world after leaving the teaching-learning situation. Fourth, help needs to be given in planning how to create supports away from the learning situation. Finally, help needs to be given the individual in developing a continuing system of learning. Now, helping pupils recognize relationships. Very quickly, let me say that this section simply dealt with the fact that it is an essential aspect of teaching to enable people to see the interrelationships among different facets of what they are dealing with in life, almost self-evident, but therefore ignored. Now let's look briefly at some of the coming changes in teaching. Having described some of the characteristics which are presently a part of the process of carrying forward the church's teaching ministry, it may be appropriate to spend a few moments examining some of the changes which seem to be looming on the horizon. As we've implied earlier, the church's educational task can never be viewed statically. It must always be open to new possibilities which may be developing within the church or outside it. Let us look at some of these under three headings: new systems, new media, and new foci. First, new systems. The word system itself is undergoing fresh scrutiny today as a result of the concept of systems analysis, which is being used extensively in government and industry. Although one major denomination, the United Presbyterian, is attempting to adapt this concept to Christian education, not enough information has been made available to give any interpretation or evaluation here. We shall use the term, therefore, to refer to ways of organizing the teaching-learning process. In this sense, I would like to look at just two among a large number of these new approaches. First, the substitution of temporary for permanent educational systems. Much of our educational work in the church has been carried on in the past on the assumption that persons would be related to a group which would have continuity and to an educational program which would develop over a long period. There are those, however, who are challenging whether it is possible to make this kind of assumption in today's culture. Kimball and McClellan have suggested that the routinized acceptance of impermanence in all forms of association is an integral feature of contemporary life. Every group is ad hoc in the sense that one's association with it is tempered by the deep implicit awareness that one must be prepared to leave whenever the right moment arrives. The ability to relate oneself effectively to other people and yet be prepared to move at any time was without doubt the most difficult demand placed upon personality by the conditions of life in contemporary society. The fact that we can do it, and often in the absence of any clear rationale for our actions, means that we have been consciously or unconsciously trained in a very effective manner. Thus, in contemporary industrial culture, one learns to leave the group. Within this sort of cultural milieu, there are those who contend that the temporary relationship is the one which gives the most promise of change. This is different, believe me, from what the church has assumed. Because of a recognized time limitation, there is a pressure to finish the task within the limited system to a degree that does not seem to exist in the system that seems to have a permanent or endless character. Under these circumstances, procedures become very important to the temporary group. The group sets up certain rules of the game within which in its miniature temporary world, which enables the members to proceed in an orderly way toward an identifiable goal within what may otherwise appear to be a chaotic and unpredictable environment. What this implies for Christian education is that we may find that more and more the church's teaching task may take place in structures which have an ad hoc and limited character. Although we may look nostalgically toward the past, when people were willing to be identified with the everlasting Bible class because it provided a sort of security, we may discover that there are some real values in the short-term group with its sense of urgency and conscious limitations. A second significant development in education is the task force concept. This is an approach which minimizes armchair theorizing and maximizes actual involvement in events. An instance from industrial education will serve as an example. In one major corporation, the director of continuing education conceived the idea that it was important for management personnel to understand the dynamics of local politics in the area where the company's headquarters was located. A task force was set up with the idea that the members could best become acquainted with the operations of the political parties by becoming involved in their operations. They began to attend party meetings. They offered their services to perform whatever jobs the party leaders gave them. At first, their presence was unsettling. The leaders didn't know what to do with such willing volunteers. But the company managers persisted. When the politicians saw that they were serious, they were given routine tasks such as distributing handbills and ringing doorbells. Gradually, the company people became accepted in party circles. They began to know where the actual power structures were, and how to establish and accomplish objectives through party machinery. This actual experience of working in the system gave the corporation executives a kind of knowledge which they could not have gained in any other way. Now contrast this with the typical church study group. One often suspects that much of the discussion of religious issues that takes place within church classes and organizations is actually a form of insulation against involvement with the realities of the situation. Recently, I heard one educator suggest that this accounted for the continuing popularity of foreign mission themes in the church. He said that it was quite possible that people liked to talk about foreign missions because they could not do much themselves except make a contribution. Meanwhile, aching needs on the church's doorstep, such as civil rights or social injustice, escaped attention. While this may seem an overstatement, there certainly is an exciting frontier for the church in education when it sees the task not only as theorizing, but also as engagement with the actual situation. Now, new media. Anyone who happens to comment upon the role of media today must inevitably be aware of Marshall McLuhan looking over his shoulder. McLuhan is so widely quoted that he seems to have preempted the field. With this Gutenberg galaxy in 1962, he began to sound the theme of our imprisonment within the lineal concept of awareness fostered by printing technology. Don't let Concordia Publishing House find that out. In understanding media, he has emphasized the importance of the rapidly broadening range of media for communication and the way in which this phenomenon is producing a new kind of learner. Although even McLuhan would not claim that books are about to disappear, there is a sense in which education is already becoming much less book-centered. Most church school curriculums today make liberal use of films, film strips, and recordings. These are already regarded as traditional media. And much more exciting technological developments are opening up new avenues for teaching and learning. As examples, look at what's happening in the storage of sight and sound. The TV taping technique has been perfected to the point where it is within the reach economically of most congregations. One experiment is now being undertaken to use the immediate playback facility of videotape as a way of training church school teachers by allowing them to see themselves in action. Equally promising is the word that a major corporation has developed a way of storing sight and sound on a disc-like phonograph record. Imagine what this would mean for providing audiovisual materials economically for use in the church school classroom. Computers open up another whole area of possibility for learning. More and more of these electronic brains are being used in secular education to provide learning programs. Computers can be programmed to make vast amounts of information instantly retrievable, and even to provide psychological encouragement to the learner. Did you know that? That in some of these learning programs, they've got it worked out so that when the kid answers right, the computer approves and says, "Nice going, very good, you're improving," and all this, and it works. Now, if the church is to stay abreast of educational technology, it's going to have to look very hard at the possibilities of computer networks providing some of the instruction in the future. One could go on and describe the miracles of microfiche systems of compressing whole books onto small cards which can be read as kind of microfilm reader. Entire religious libraries for congregations could be made available cheaply in a form that could be stored in a few inches of shelf space. Now, what's he supposed to do?
Yeah, when would you go to the
lost bag? Oh. Thought it was a lost coin. I had to try to figure out which one it was. Well, I was talking about this business of microfiche. You know, it's a microfilm technique which puts the microfilm on a little card, and you can store a whole book on a couple of cards. And I was saying entire religious libraries for congregations could be made available cheaply in a form that could be stored in a few inches of shelf space. And such educational tools are developing so rapidly that it's difficult to keep pace with all of them. But this much is true. A teaching church must avail itself of the potential in these new media. Looked upon in one way, they might be seen as gifts from God's world to use in the more effective communication of His Word. Now, new foci. Just as new means of education will be open to the church in the future, it's likely there will be new points of emphasis and new definitions of purpose. Some of these will come as a result of insights regarding education itself. Others will result from a reassessment of the church's task in the context of the times. Let me mention very briefly just four of these foci. I hope I got four here. Yeah, I got four. First, there is likely to be a rethinking of the kind of education that can take place in early childhood. Recently, a panel of 25 experts selected as the most important piece of educational research in the last decade, Benjamin S. Bloom's Stability and Change in Human Characteristics. One of his major findings was that general intelligence appears to develop as much from conception to age 4 as it does during the 14 years from age 4 to age 18. This means that early childhood education is of incalculable importance. His findings have given impetus to such projects as Head Start and have helped to revive interest in nursery schools and kindergartens. Hope somebody's asking himself, does this contradict what I said in the question period a while ago? Think about it. As a result of his research, Bloom contends that the education of the very young should stress intellectual development rather than play activities. Bloom holds that children should be helped perceive the world and describe it through verbal forms. Emphasis should be placed upon learning concepts, and children should be challenged to expend real effort in the process of learning. If we were to take this seriously in the church, it might well revolutionize what we now do in a kind of holy babysitting operation in our church schools. Second, there is an emerging emphasis in all forms of education upon the release of creativity among pupils. Harold Anderson puts it, to live creatively is to live truthfully. It is to live truthfully as one himself sees the truth. To live merely according to the truth as someone else sees it is not creative. It is conformity. As more and more educators devote time to the search for ways to unleash the creative potential of persons, we may assume that these are the kind of people whom we will find in our churches. Already we see signs of this happening in the caliber of young people who are in our schools and youth groups. These are not submissive persons who are easily forced into lockstep learning and acquiescence to accepted positions. If we are to meet such people on their own grounds, we're going to have to develop Christian education which provides for creativity. Furthermore, we must be willing to run the risk of freeing the creative mind to explore and challenge our most cherished views. Third, one of the inescapable facts of Christian education in the coming decades is that it's likely to become more and more ecumenical education. The signs of this are already evident. The National Council of Churches presently has a commission at work which includes both Protestants and Roman Catholics. Their task is to find avenues for ecumenical education. Projects such as the Living Room Dialogue among Catholics, Orthodox, and Protestants are gaining wide popularity. Unless Lutherans wish to live in the future in their own religious ghetto, we must find ways of being true to our own heritage while learning to work effectively in the total educational process with our Christian brethren. I propose no easy solution to how this can be done, but I pose it as an unavoidable concern. Fourth, we may find that the focus of Christian education in the near future will be sharpened by one overriding concern, man's search for meaning. As I indicated earlier in these lectures, modern secular man wanders lone and confused in a universe that has become strangely alien to him. The familiar landmarks of tradition are either gone or clouded by questioning. Into this miasma moves the church with a clean, clear air of truth. It declares that man's meaning is to be found in his relationship with God's ultimate meaning. This will not be easy for the man of tomorrow to accept because it runs counter to so much that his culture conveys. But this is the church's task in a way that has never been apparent before. And precisely because this problem is one of meaning and the way a man perceives meaning, it is a viable area for educational action. Now a final word. As we draw these lectures to a close, I'm aware that I have not presented neat answers to the perplexing educational tasks which face the church today. In part, that's because no formula could embody the spirit with which the church must move. But I'm persuaded that move she must, because it is God's way. He has always seemed to call his people to impossible tasks and then given them the strength to accomplish them. Several years ago, before the Iron Curtain closed so decisively between East and West Germany, I had the opportunity to preach at an early service in West Berlin, and then later to attend a service in the Marienkirche in East Berlin. That afternoon I spent with the pastor of the East Berlin congregation, and he told me about the struggle that had faced himself and his people. Before the Second World War, this congregation had had the practice of confirming about 600 young people per year. That year, there had been two. But he said he thanked God for those two, because he said somehow he felt that they understood what it meant to be counted for Christ in a way that the hundreds had not sensed before. They knew that it might mean the end of all of their future hope of a good place in society, and that they might be outcasts among their own people. That evening, as I stood at the window of my hotel in the West Zone, looked out across the diamond mantle of brilliance which is the West to the brownout of the East, I had a feeling that God was somehow moving out there. And probably it was in the unlikely place that God was now able to be most active. And the words came back to my mind of a book that I had read many years before called The Flock by Mary Austin, in which she says, I have never seen a flock of sheep all lie down at the same time. As if by prearrangement, some will stand. They will scan the rim of the world for danger. When the time comes for the tired watchers to fold their knees and lie down, the obligation passes like a sigh through the bedded flock and troubles the appointed ones. And when it does, with a hint of shaking of resistance in their side, they get there upon their feet to take their place and sniff the tainted wind and scan the world for danger. Now I have a feeling that perhaps God moves like that through his flock, that he troubles the appointed ones and gives to them the task of guarding the flock for him. If you are very fortunate this hour, perhaps he's troubling you.